Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. As people spend more of their lives online, chatting, sharing photos, shopping, banking, job hunting, computing, corporate giants are organizing, storing, and policing more and more of our data in what's being called the Internet Cloud. Soon, it seems, there may be nothing left that really lives on your home computer. On the PC at the office, it may all be online, up in the cloud. Some say that's great or inevitable. My guest today, Jonathan Zittrain, worries we are losing too much control. This hour, On Point, cloud computing and what it means when everything goes online. You can join the conversation. Is all your data, your computing life, already online in the Internet cloud? Do you worry it will get away from you? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, speaking of in the cloud, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Cambridge, Massachusetts, is Jonathan Zittrain, professor of law at Harvard Law School, co-founder of the Berkman Center for Internet and Society, where he served as the first executive director from 97 to 2000. He's author of The Future of the Internet and How to Stop It. He wrote an op-ed piece in the New York Times recently headlined Lost in the Cloud. Jonathan Zittrain, thanks very much for being here.
Thanks so much for having me.
So this is really in the headlines lately. We're reading more and more about it, and it can sound pretty good. I mean, Google and others are developing all kinds of things. Google's come out with this Chrome where you can play games and store photos and work on spreadsheets. It's all free. You don't have to buy that big Microsoft software package. It sounds pretty inviting, Jonathan. What's the problem?
Well, I agree. It not only sounds inviting, but there are elements of it that are terrific. It's almost a natural progression as we get saturated with internet access all over the place, 24/7 and very good bandwidth. It makes a lot of sense in some ways to take the information that normally we would have in our pocket on a cell phone or in front of us on a laptop and store it out there somewhere other than where we are. So that if we lose that device that we have, we don't lose all the data associated with it, and that we can have it available 24/7 to interact with all sorts of other people's data. So in that sense, I think by this definition of cloud computing, it's a really interesting and useful phenomenon, at least as exciting as the movement from the telephone answering machine to voicemail. And there may even have been a time when people were a little reluctant to trust their telephone messages to voicemail, but then this is what we do now. The worries I have about it happen to be a correlation at times between moving your data away from you and into some other entity's custody and your ability to control it, an inverse correlation there, mm-hmm. that as you move the data away from you, it doesn't have to be this way, but often typically you end up with a little less control, and that means that the entities with which you interact can do stuff with the data that might surprise you. It means that regulators might be able to demand of those entities access to the data in a way that they wouldn't normally be able to do if it just happened to be in your house. And those are the sorts of things I think we need to be planning ahead for so that as we move to the cloud, we get the good stuff and not the bad stuff.
Before we go to those concerns in more detail, give us a few more of the basics here about what we're talking about. I mean, I think it sounds esoteric or exotic, cloud computing. For an awful lot of people active online, it's so natural and so frequent these days that they barely think about it. Microsoft's operating systems have run, what, more than 90% of the world's PCs, I think still do. But describe exactly what it is that's going on in the process of moving to cloud computing. What does it mean in real terms?
Well, it's interesting. It's probably important to clear up front that cloud means different things to different people. It's such a convenient metaphor.
Yeah,
you can see
up there,
it being used
out there.
In
mm-hmm.
exactly several different ways. So some of the ways very quickly in which it's been used are by some internet engineers, it means the quote-unquote middle of the internet, where the data goes after it's left you but before it lands wherever it's supposed to be. Mm. And that's not generally the definition that we see people talking about these days colloquially. Another definition is storing the data on someone else's machine somewhere out there who's probably bigger than you are. Mm. And that would include the Googles and Microsofts and others of the world. And that's why an announcement by Google of something like Chrome as an operating system, with the idea being to have a really lightweight, easy-to-use device whose basic purpose in life is to just get you into a web browser so everything you do happens online.
And is that what Chrome is? It means I don't need any Microsoft operating system at all on my home PC?
Absolutely. That's the newest idea behind Chrome. It's a little confusing because Chrome has started out as a browser that you can download on your Microsoft or other machine from Google instead of, say, Internet Explorer or Firefox. But the most recent announcement from Google says, we're going to make an entire Chrome operating system. And that's the kind of operating system, since its only purpose in life is to run this browser, that could boot in just a few seconds instead of waiting 30 seconds for it to start up. That might be less susceptible to viruses because the machine is not designed to do anything but be that browser. And as a result, it doesn't have to distinguish between good programs and bad programs because it's only got one program.
Now, when people talk about Google and Microsoft therefore competing, it's pretty easy to see how that's the case. If I go to Chrome Office system and only operating system and only use that, I'm not going to be buying Microsoft software. But is that how Google sees it, that they would really would or will compete right across the board, whether it's spreadsheets or any other function, not just my addresses or some photos stored someplace, not just storage, but real numbers crunching and everything they'd compete with?
That's certainly the idea, that it will seem as old-fashioned to be running applications like Word and Excel on your local machine, applications that should they get a little stale would have to be refreshed by downloading patches and things like that, and that could be corrupted by viruses and other malware, that Google says, yes, move it out onto the web and we will offer you Google Docs, which is a counterpart to your normal word processing, and you can store all your documents online. And because it's online 24/7, even when your computer isn't turned on, you can share your documents with your friends and they can make edits and you can work collaboratively in teams and things like that. But I think it's also important to remember that for many of these companies that we're talking about, they have extant cash flows. Microsoft still makes a big pile of money off of its operating system and the Office suite of applications, billions of dollars a year. And Google makes a big pile of money each year from a huge river of cash flowing next door to Mountain View called Search and Google AdWords. And they can take that money and do whatever they want with it. So it's kind of like, where do we want to go today? What services do we want to offer? What business plan do we want to engage that may or may not look a lot like what the business plan in the past has been? And I think that's one of the reasons you see Google aspiring to, under the rubric of organizing the world's information, getting into a whole bunch of businesses. And Microsoft has been doing the same thing. They tried to jump on the internet bandwagon a little late, but things like the Microsoft Network and their new Bing search engine show that I think they realize that the future may not be in spreadsheets running on your computer. In fact, they have Office Live now, which is a bunch of their applications normally that you'd find on your computer running in the cloud, just like Google's.
And your concern is that as we give up that software-based, within reach, literally on our desktop, certainly on our computer desktop, as it floats off into the cloud, number one, others have more control than they did over our data, and we have less. And you're also concerned about innovation in the digital arena when the cloud becomes the venue for computing.
Well, that's true. And the first set of concerns I describe as sort of the easy stuff, not necessarily easy to actually solve in real life, but theoretically, we kind of know some of the dangers of third parties getting access to your data when it happens to be stored only behind a password somewhere in the cloud, or the government can get access to it if it presents something even less than a warrant to one of your service providers who may not even end up telling you. But as you say, innovation is another really important variable that's getting affected by things. And I think the best way to think about it is to realize that the movement from your PC as the locus of where your code runs to the code being somewhere out in the cloud where you just go to a web address and there's your spreadsheet waiting for you, it turns your software from a product that you obtain either by paying money or getting it from a friend or free software.
Therefore, you own, it's your property.
Exactly, or at least it feels that way. Mm-hmm. There'd be some lawyers that might argue that, it's just licensed. But yes, you feel like it's your property and you get to control it. It's in your custody. It turns that product into a service, and the service gets changed and tweaked and updated at any time by the vendor, either because the vendor has its own motives, its own change in business plan, or because regulators demand that of the vendor in a way that they could not have demanded it or never did try to demand it in the old configuration. They never tried to get Bill Gates, for instance, to kill off peer-to-peer music sharing software, even as the music industry was so upset at what they saw as rampant piracy. Bill Gates was never told you have to kill it because nobody figured he could. You already bought the computer and the operating system. It was yours. If, on the other hand, that software is either running literally in the cloud, say on a Facebook apps platform or one of these other applications platforms for which the coders today are now writing and you're running it out on that platform, you can have the government pressure or order them to alter or eliminate the code. And that's also, by the way, why, to my eye, when I look at great products like the iPhone, it actually acts more like a cloud service than a traditional tiny computer in your hand, because Apple gets to decide what code will or will not be made available to you, and you have to get it through the Apple store. And Apple can kill apps in a way that Bill Gates, Mr. Proprietary, never dreamed of.
There are a lot of angles here. We're going to touch many of them, but just a quick question before we go to a break right here, Jonathan. You've got concerns, but isn't this movement inevitable, inexorable, that big word? I mean, it's going there, isn't it? It's almost a done deal.
Well, there certainly are lots of vectors pushing in that direction. And in that sense, I don't want to be the old coot saying, you know, keep the Model T. I don't like these newfangled cars. And I don't think I am calling for that. Instead, what I'm saying is before we've really fully immersed in it, there are actually some tweaks that we can do, some changes that we can make that will bring some of the best elements we had naturally when we owned PCs in the normal way. We can bring some of those elements into the cloud with us and make it a much better experience for us and protect innovation and privacy in ways that maybe some of the cloud vendors, in their kind of pell-mell rush to get this up and running, they say, oh, we'll worry about that later.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about cloud computing, when everything heads off your computer desktop and onto the web, and what it means for you and for the computing industry. We've been joined by Jonathan Zittrain, professor of law at Harvard Law School, author of a recent op-ed piece called Lost in the Cloud in the New York Times. We're joined right now from San Francisco by Kara Swisher, technology columnist for the Wall Street Journal. Kara Swisher, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you.
Thanks a lot.
So, first of all, what's going on here? Is this inevitable? Is all computing on the way, you know, online, away from our packaged software? Is the PC going to just be a little machine that hooks to the web, the cloud, and that's it?
Well, you just said it. Yeah, absolutely. I think pretty much the modern software industry as we know it, you know, as exemplified by Microsoft, is finished, and including Microsoft is putting most things online in a cloud-like form. So I think that it's not a question of, you know, if it's going to happen and what the implications are, is a question of when it's going to happen and how we're going to deal with it and if the same laws are going to apply.
How far are we into that process now? I mean, I understand different people will be in different places, but overall, how far are we into this evolution away from the desktop software package?
Oh, very much so. I mean, I think it's not, I don't think it's going to happen overnight. Microsoft still controls so much of the software, and they're about to introduce a new version, Windows 7.
Right.
But I think, and most people do have software on their computers and use software, but, you know, when's the last time you loaded up a computer disk into your computer?
Mm-hmm.
Not very often.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, even Microsoft is updating your computer via the Internet, and so does, you know, every software update I have on my Apple computer is done by the cloud, this, you know, scary cloud. And unfortunately, I mean, there are definitely privacy implications. There's all kinds of implications, but it's, you know, it's sort of like arguing, you know, cars are real dangerous, but the fact of the matter is we use them.
We drive them, and we drive them fast. Give us a little tour of the industry horizon here, then. Google seems to be making the big noise about
one
moving in this direction. But, all right, there's the Google-Microsoft rivalry now. We just had the head of Google step off of Apple's board of directors because of talk about competition there. What does the competitive landscape look like around this movement to cloud computing, Kara?
Well, that's mostly technology writers trying to create a war or a horse race, much the same way political writers like to. But, you know, they are. Everyone's vying to be able to be in control of this cloud. And there's a lot of companies, and there's also a lot of little companies vying. I mean, you have companies like Facebook and Twitter and all kinds of different consumer companies, and then there's a whole spate of business-oriented companies like LinkedIn and Salesforce.com. And so there's tons and tons of companies competing in this space, and I think there's going to be, as there was in the software industry, probably a few major players and then a lot of smaller players. Ultimately, it coalesced into a couple major, in fact, one major player in the software industry, really. You know, and maybe an Intuit kind of thing. And even Intuit's putting all their stuff online. So, you know, and that's in the accounting tax space. So I think a lot of companies are going to be part of this, and it's just a question of who's going to own which part of it.
Google's model has been advertising-based in search. Yeah. Of course, Microsoft has been, you know, sell you that package when you, right. you buy the PC or upgrade it. What's the model around cloud computing and all the support and the huge server farms and everything else that goes into yeah. supporting it?
Well, it is cheaper, actually. You don't have to build a box and
right.
plastic around
right.
it and
right.
ship it in a truck. I mean, there's all kinds of savings that you have. It's going to be the similar thing. You're going to buy a subscription to it, you know, or and it will update as they improve. And actually, I think that's a lot of a better model than the old ones because they can, you know, they improve over time rather than you have to constantly be buying new software and being behind in your upgrades. So I like that better. But at the same time, it obviously introduces all kinds of complications into it.
And what about the risks of people snooping around when all your stuff is up there, you know, somewhere in the ether? Here, speaking of Twitter, here's Randy on Twittering to us. Hello, people. The regulators have had access to all our data forever. Anyway, cloud computing equals no change.
Exactly.
Is that true?
That's pretty much it. I think people have had access for a long time. And you go to the supermarket and you scan cat food and a certain bunch of things, they can tell a lot about you and what you're buying. And so we've sort of entered the computer generation, and it's hard to argue that we're going to go back. I mean, people may not like it, but it's the way things are. And I think, the issue is we have to just strengthen already existing privacy issues and transfer a lot of the behaviors we've had previously. You know, you can argue, you know, credit cards are dangerous, and they are in a lot of ways, but they're dangerous from the waiter who takes your order, and they're dangerous from the person who hacks into it. So it's not, you know, it's a little more of a danger when people are across the world and doing that. It's hard to figure that out, but it's inevitable kind of thing.
Jonathan Zittrain in Cambridge, how do you see that? A real measurable large difference in data security and folks' access, government access, or, you know, our Twitter here says, hello, that's the way it's mm-hmm. been.
Well, I wouldn't want Randy's appropriate cynicism about everything to mask the fact that there really is a sea change going on here. And maybe the best way to see it is to see the ways in which our traditional appliances that we think of as definite products in our houses are being changed by this concept of cloud computing, the way that Kara was describing it. Mm. So, for example, there's a OnStar system in many people's cars. It is a little blue button you can press, and a voice comes over your speakers in your car and says, yes, may I help you? And you mm-hmm. say, I've fallen and I can't get up. And
right.
you know, they know where your car is, that kind of thing. Very convenient. There's actually an instance in which the government, the FBI, simply went to an OnStar-like company that provided these services and demanded of them that they turn on remotely through a software upgrade the microphone in a car containing people of interest to the FBI.
And to listen in on their conversation.
All conversations whenever they were in the car. And that's something that, thanks to the fact that the car is in communications with the mothership, that they can do and do very subtly and that you wouldn't have had before. You bought your car, you own your car, it's your car. It's not connected to anyone else.
But that's not cloud computing. What's the real danger here that hasn't been there already, if there is one?
Well, I think that is a new danger in the sense that is an aspect of cloud computing because by my lights, when I think of the heart of cloud computing, it's the idea of having some intermediary, whether it's Google or Microsoft or an OnStar-like company, really controlling your technology environment. Not, I don't mean that in some Orwellian fashion necessarily. It can be really convenient and good. That's why I'm not really fighting it wholeheartedly. But I see prospects for abuse. One other quick example, some people listening may have EchoStar dish systems, and some of those dish systems for satellite television reception have with them digital video recorders like mm-hmm. TiVo's built in. In fact, mm-hmm. they're so much like TiVo that TiVo sued EchoStar for infringing its patent on the DVR. And that case went on, and eventually there was a jury verdict in favor of TiVo, and EchoStar owed them tens of millions of dollars, and normally, if this weren't a cloud story, it would have ended there. But because those devices are tethered to the mothership, TiVo actually asked and got the judge to order EchoStar to send a signal that would fry millions of EchoStar DVRs. It would be a feature upgrade to kill them, to brick them, because they're infringing patents. And in the past, you wouldn't have had the patent police knocking down your door searching for illegal mousetraps. In this case, by the way, I should add, it's on appeal. It's been on appeal for about a year and a half. and EchoStar hasn't fried anything yet, and TiVo is asking for contempt since they haven't.
Yeah. Kara, what do you say?
EchoStar stole that patent. I mean, that's the allegation. So I don't know why EchoStar should benefit from selling an illegal product.
But do we need some new structure of regulation or industry standards as we move everything sort of out of our homes, out of our offices, up there into the cloudosphere?
I think it has to reflect what's going on. I mean, I think we probably have a lot of the laws in place. It's just a question of enforcing them and changing them. I mean, it reminds me a little about the debate over, child pornography laws Washington loves to debate that issue. There are laws in place to deal with this. It's just an acknowledgement of possible differences that you might have to deal with as you move along, and that's just a question of legislating intelligently. Whether that happens, that's not clear. That's never clear that's going to happen, and there's a lot of other things Washington has to deal with. I think they just have to intelligently understand how this is happening and what it can demand. And in the case of the government invading people's homes, it's instead of sneaking into someone's car and lighting it up, they're just doing it a different way. I don't know if it's a different thing. It's probably a more convenient way for the FBI agents to do things like that.
But it's certainly
they're gonna do it anyway.
It's certainly unsettling when it becomes that easy. Jonathan, give us in a nutshell. You've got several things you're proposing that you say would lay a groundwork for what, more privacy and more innovation in a cloud computing era? Like what, in a nutshell?
Well, I've got a few ideas, depending on which aspect of the problem we're wanting to solve. On the innovation front, I'm interested in a number of actions that people can take, some within government, some without, so that the new software platforms, the operating systems of the future that Kara convincingly argues are going to be replacing the venerable Microsoft Windows and other desktop-based platforms,
right,
that they have the same kind of openness to outside code being introduced, interesting, subversive, game-changing code that might be threatening to some interests, but that previously those interests wouldn't have been able to simply flip a switch and turn it off, ways to preserve that kind of neutrality so that the platform maker isn't always deciding on any basis they choose what will run and what won't, sometimes just for reasons to preserve their own dominance. It was interesting. There was a battle between Google and Apple recently where Google had written certain iPhone applications that you could download and run on the iPhone that would bring you to certain Google services. And Apple said, no, we'd prefer not to have those on the phone. And there are plenty of customers that would want it. And you don't always have the market itself correcting that, because once you've got your iPhone and your 2-year contract and all your applications and all your data
locked up.
Exactly. You have to be really upset to want to move. So figuring out a little way to oil the gears better to promote competition seems to me a really good idea. And in some ways, I'd like to see some of the software developers of the world unite. And when they normally don't read the boilerplate and the fine print about what
legalese,
the vendor or the platform demands of them, to be able actually to come together and say, you know what, these are the kinds of changes we want if we're going to code for your platform. And that applies a perfectly appropriate market pressure.
Kara, let us pick that up. What about the industry dynamic here?
Well,
been. Is it different in cloud computing? Do you see less innovation and more locked up systems?
No, not at all. In fact, we're living in a world where 90% of the world's computers work on one company's software. So I would welcome anything below 90% at this point. And the second thing is that, the Google Voice thing, which is, an interesting issue. I mean, and not everybody has an iPhone. It still is not, compared to most phones, the biggest phone around. But that said, they're exhibiting market power of people who happen to like the elite iPhone. But the fact of the matter is this has gotten widespread attention very quickly because of the way the people using it. I mean, this is going to get addressed much more quickly than the long-time dominance of Microsoft over. I mean, it took the federal government to get that. I think through pressure and all kinds of things and through the way the system works where things get revealed rather quickly, probably at some point Apple's going to give up instead of, continuing to fight this issue. Because the more closed down they become, the less people are going to use it. That said, people tend to like the Apple system because it's a closed system, and one of the things that Apple's known for is its sort of fascist approach to everything where they run everything. And you do get a better experience, but what you trade is, with Steve
Some
Jobs
that openness.
Says goes,
yep.
pretty much.
Let's get a call from Greenville, South Carolina, and David. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Hey, Tom.
Hi.
I do work in the legal field. I'm a consultant.
Okay.
So a lot of my work product is covered by work product privilege because I'm doing it on behalf of an attorney, so it's highly confidential, privileged information.
Mm-hmm.
I can't put this data out in the cloud without because I just don't believe that it's secure enough. And I think from my micro-sized company all the way up to the Walmarts of the world, there's trade secrets and confidential information that's just never going to be able to be transferred to some cloud because of the lack of confidence in the security and the legal requirements that are on us that have
right.
to protect that.
That is a fascinating angle on this. Jonathan Zittrain, you're at Harvard Law School. What about it? Here's David. You know, he's got privileged information. Can he, is he within his rights to deal with it out in a cloud computing setting, or is he potentially betraying a client's confidentiality when and if he does that? What about it?
Well, I think people with sensitivities like that will be among the last to migrate towards the cloud, but I don't think it's a show-stopping concern. It might take a page from the book of the medical establishments, the insurance companies, the healthcare providers, who, thanks to a somewhat obscure federal law called HIPAA, have been kind of blandished into electronicizing a lot of their records and trying to make them interoperable so that you can zap a patient's record up to Medicare for reimbursement and have it all happen digitally. And that has aspects of cloud computing to it. And there's been a cottage industry of consultants and computing companies that have sprung up in order to achieve the kind of privacy you'd want for that data, even though it's zooming around, possibly even over internet pathways. It's not on public websites.
Right.
So I think we'll see ways in which firms, especially the larger enterprise spaces, can and are already being able to use a kind of end-to-end encryption and other tools to try to make the cloud experience at least as safe as doing it online.
I've got another caller on that front from Wilmington, Massachusetts. Tim, you're on the air.
Yes, hello, Tom.
Hi.
Hello, Jonathan.
Hi there.
I just wanted to point out that not only, because you're talking a lot about public cloud,
right.
Google, Amazon, there's also something called private cloud. Your enterprise, so for instance, that law office that the last caller was talking about.
Yes, David.
Mm-hmm. David, right, he might benefit from private cloud, where your organization can hold applications and data centrally on a machine in your own organization. You can secure it yourself.
Would that be as secure as, you know, physical software on a disk on a hard drive?
Well, essentially, we're already doing it, sort of. We're already storing files on our file servers. You might
right.
do that currently. The only difference is that you're changing infrastructure so that you have the computing power is now shifted to the server rather than your laptop that I'm sitting
right.
in front of right now, for
mm-hmm.
instance. So if I log into something in my server, it does the computing for me, and then I can have an underpowered, what maybe a netbook, for instance, and still get the work done. Everything is then done for people like myself and the network engineers, network security engineers, easier to secure, easier to manage on one system rather than going to everybody's computers and making sure their virus patterns are up to date.
Right, sure. Of course. No, it's a great point, Tim. Kara, are we going to see or have we already seen private clouds? Maybe our attorney in South Carolina can arrange one.
Sure, there's a private cloud. They already exist.
Mm-hmm.
With your email system in a corporate environment.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's a cloud. If you think about it,
is that security equivalent to what you would have had
What is secure? I mean, look at the government of Britain had all the social security numbers of everyone in the country, or a big swath of them, on a disk they mailed to each other. I mean, these kind of things.
Right.
I mean,
right.
to me, they're much safer in a cloud environment because it's at least trackable on some level.
You don't leave the laptop on a bus and suddenly everybody's got it.
I mean, it's like a million servers. It's just the question is, are we comfortable in a computing environment? And I think that, you know, however they want to structure, if you want to be a private cloud, which exists already, period. I mean, everyone works
mm-hmm.
from, I work
right.
from VPN with Dow Jones. I mean,
mm-hmm.
that kind of stuff happens all the time. I upload things constantly. It's not even, I mean, it's just that less and less we're going to be using software and more we're going to be using online systems. And the question is making them strong enough, you know, and unhackerable enough, which is also impossible, just the way it's impossible to completely strengthen your office or home against a burglar.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about cloud computing, when everything heads off your computer desktop and on to the web. Kara Swisher is with us. Technology columnist for The Wall Street Journal joins us today from San Francisco. Jonathan Zittrain is here from Harvard Law School. He's a co-founder of the Berkman Center for Internet and Society, follows privacy and innovation and legal issues around all things digital there. Let's get a call from Cambridge, Massachusetts. And Josh, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
I wanted to just comment. I work for a small software development company, and we use several cloud services. And basically what it's done for us is that we now can use the cloud, pay a few $100s a year for a service that our own employees would have to manage before. It's not changing what we do. Mm-hmm. It's not revolutionary for our business, but it is making us more efficient, able to deliver a better product. And the reason I say that it's not revolutionary is that this has all actually happened before, back in the 70s and the 80s. Everybody was actually on the cloud. You had a terminal at your desk, and there was a mainframe somewhere in your institution that did all the computing, and then we switched from the cloud, as it were, the private cloud then, to desktops, and now we're switching back. It's really just a constant cycle that goes on in the technology world.
Do you feel any controversy or concerns around cloud computing in your world, Josh, or no, it's just what you do?
There are certainly concerns, and we can't put certain client data on the cloud, but for the most part, in general, I think the market does handle that. You know, a company that's not secure is going to be passed over for a company that has better security policy, for example. And I think Google's taken a hit on that. They're trying to take Microsoft's market share, and then it came out last year that they had a bug in their software that allowed some private dive tools that were set as private to be visible to the world. So when things like that happen, suddenly any company that was considering switching from a Microsoft platform isn't going to do so. So the market will make it happen that when the companies are ready to have more and more secure data on the cloud, they'll make their way over there. It's a steady, slow process.
So there's some market discipline right there, but you're well on your way already. Jonathan Zittrain, here's from our website. Dennis writes that in the developing world, cloud computing is an absolute boon to business formation, entrepreneurship, because one of the great costs of business formation is kept in check by cloud computing. You hear the same thing in a way from Josh saying, this is good for entrepreneurs because you can jump in and get going with lower cost. That surely is an aspect of innovation potential, Jonathan.
It sure is. And I can't disagree with anything that either Josh or Dennis is suggesting there. It's just worth noting that in the enterprise space, whether you're just you're a firm, you have a product to sell, and you're trying to keep accounts receivable in line, it could make a lot of sense to put that online and to have it outsourced. In fact, that's a lot of what IT outsourcing is about, and it's cutting costs and making things easier, perhaps except for the people laid off who used to be on your IT staff. But that's because you don't see those firms needing to embrace kind of goofy innovation that seems outlandish and from left field and trivial at first, think Twitter, and then later turns out to be something central. To be able to develop the World Wide Web at all, it was so important that you happened to have a bunch of both businesses and individuals who had general purpose computers so they could say, what's this weird browser I'm hearing about? Mosaic? And I'm gonna load up Mosaic or whatever this thing is called and look at web pages. But that's exactly how it could happen, very organically. And in that sense, I can see how enterprises could rightfully be totally excited about this while still thinking from an overall systemic view, how do we preserve a space where anybody with that interesting idea can put it out there and let it get adopted by people who happen to already have the hardware? Another quick example of that might be so-called ad hoc mesh networking. So the next time Hurricane Katrina comes through or you have some other natural disaster, the phone lines are down, your internet access is gone, and by the way, with that, so is everything that you would access over the internet.
Right.
If you have a reprogrammable PC, you might be able to load up just a little bit of software that has it talk to the nearest three PCs that it can find, and they talk outward to the nearest three that they can find. And before you know it, you have a little bucket brigade that gets data and information into and out of that disaster area by pushing it to the edges, and then they join the internet at large.
Right.
And that's made possible because you've got a reprogrammable machine.
Kara, how about that? I mean, you talked about Apple being pretty tough, for example, on what comes into its world, into its arena. Jonathan wants to champion, the goofy, weird, transgressive, ultimately game-changing. Is the space for that going to be diminished here?
No, there's there's never been more innovation in Silicon Valley than today. I mean, look at Twitter going from 0 to 100 miles per hour in seconds. I mean, there's so many companies now being able to be started because the costs are so much lower. And I would say this is the great era of innovation, even at a company as incredibly controlling as Apple. But look at the whole apps market on Apple. Mm-hmm. It's like tons and tons of small companies innovating. And I think this cloud computing frees people from that idea of a single dominant provider or two or three dominant providers. And you know, I have never seen more innovation and excitement of people being able to design than before. And more to the point, it doesn't really matter because it's really not about you or me or Jonathan. It's about young people, and they really do are comfortable in this paradigm, and they are not going back. You know, the customer likes this, and the inevitable customer, my children, for example, like this, and they're not going back. Young people put stuff up on Facebook. They're used to dealing in these kind of environments, and this is how they're going to, you know, it's sort of like liking, you know, electric windows in cars. Not many people do roll-up windows anymore, and I happen to like them, but I'm 103 years old. But, you know, I mean, I think it just doesn't matter because this is the way it is, and this is how people operate. This is how entrepreneurs operate, how young people operate, how everything is going.
But Jonathan's raising the concern that there's simply, by definition, more leeway in the old world of software than there is in cloud computing, where parameters can be laid down and you just can't, you know, take it home to your basement and wiggle around it.
What's wrong with wiggling around in it? I mean, I think you can do that. I think the problem with the old software system is that you ended up with these coalescing around one or two major players. Mm-hmm. You know, there's one software player in operating systems, really, inevitably speaking. There's pretty much Intuit sort of dominates. And there used to be tons of financial software companies. Mm-hmm. Intuit kind of dominates it. And now there's tons of gaming companies. There's tons of online cloud-based financial systems going on right now. Now, not all of them are going to be successful, and there may be one or two big ones, but there's more chance of getting a lot of them than a fewer of them.
Jonathan, pull back the lens then a little bit. Maybe is it possible you're too tightly focused on the parameters individual companies lay down? You know, Kara says you've never had more innovation than now.
Well, I think there's a real power to her point. I agree that there's tons of interesting stuff still going on the web and on the internet. But I guess I wouldn't want to think that 8 different apps on the iPhone, all of which have it make a funny noise when you push a button, is kind of, mm-hmm. you know, qualitatively the same as some of the game-changing stuff that can happen when people are free to run the code that they want without an intermediary being in a position to say no or to be told by a regulator to say no. That's kind of the big difference to me. And it's awfully, I agree, it's hard for me to make this case when I can't tell you the innovation that hasn't happened
right,
as a result.
Right.
It's hard to do that unless you have a few case studies of apps that almost got out of the bag and regulators got to push them back again. And for that, we've had a couple examples on both code and content. You know, you can look at the Amazon Kindle story where these ebook readers from Amazon that are completely controlled by Amazon, and in that sense to me are a cloud-oriented device, they're controlled from afar. People had paid for and downloaded Orwell's 1984 on the Kindles, and it turns out that the entity selling the book didn't have the rights in the United States to do so, and Amazon sent a signal that deleted 1984 from everybody's devices. And I guess you could look at that either as Kara had reacted to the earlier case of TiVo versus EchoStar and say, mm-hmm. hey, if it's illegal, what's the problem? We got to get rid of the illegal stuff. Or you could say, wow, this is weird. You know, normally you buy a book, you bring it home. Maybe a court finds it infringes copyright or it defames somebody, but it's your book and the library is going to hang on to its copy too. And now you can seize it centrally. The only silver lining maybe there is that it's such an extreme example and created such a backlash that even Amazon has been sort of chastened by its reaction and has offered some promises that it doesn't plan to do that again.
But Carol, a lot of headlines off that 1984 clawback. Yeah. What do you say? What about that?
It was a perfect book, wasn't it? I was like, loving it. I think that they apologize, and they made a stupid error on that part, and it was immediately outed when they did it. So, again, this huge feedback cycle that goes on online is really powerful for all kinds of companies, you know, kind of thing. So I think things are much more revealed when things like this happen. Now, eventually this will happen a lot, but I think Amazon realized this is sort of a see-as-we-go kind of thing, and I think Amazon realized they were wrong. There were probably better ways to – they might wanted to inform readers. We don't own the rights to these – and then talked to the rights holder and said, we've sold 10,000 of these. Can we please have the rights to them? And then stop selling them after that. They could have done a lot of things. They just acted like boneheads in that case. And I think they clawed it back, and they're probably trying to fix it right now because they look like imbeciles.
Right. Jonathan, there was a legal issue there, but what kind of... You can't name the specific innovation, but is there other types of innovations that you can see business reasons that some of these cloud computing companies might not want to permit or encourage? You know, that might be good innovations, but would challenge them, I guess, in business terms, and therefore they try to give a break on.
Yeah, I suppose any category of innovation that's seen to threaten an incumbent that may have the ear of government or other means of kind of controlling entry into the market could fall into that space. So voice over internet protocol is an example. There are still plenty of places around the world where it's very difficult to use something like Skype for free voice-to-voice communications to another Skype user because the incumbents in that country don't want to see it used that way. And often the incumbents are the governments themselves who control, as a state monopoly, the telephone services. And you also see, because Skype itself as an application is a so-called black box, it's not like anybody really knows how Skype works except the makers of Skype, who are also the same folks that brought us Kazaa, peer-to-peer networking.
Right.
They could be asked by the Chinese government to make the Chinese version of Skype something that will filter out keywords that are sensitive to the government or that will record the instant messaging chats that are part of Skype and be able to send it back to the government on request. And so those are the kinds of things where I would love to see technology structured so that even if pressure arises from governments to do stuff that we might find crossing certain lines, they simply aren't able to require that.
Dan in Fort Myers, Florida. Dan, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I was just confused about, there's been some stories lately that people store their information on these free storage sites and they put their information out on the cloud, and then the companies go out of business and, the next day and they're losing all of their personal photographs and files. And
yep.
What do you think about that?
Kara Swisher, what do you say to that?
That's the biggest problem, I would say. I would say that's a more, it's an inconvenient problem, but yes, there has to be sort of rules in place to what happens to the data after you put it up there and a company does close. That's a very, actually, an important problem. I just did that Clear thing where, they took a picture of my eyeball and to get through security lines easier at the airport, which, of course, Jonathan would never do, but I don't care.
Believe it or not, I did it, but it just folded.
Yeah, folded.
Well, that's what you're going to say, isn't it?
So they have my eyeball information. I'm not quite sure where my eyeball information is right now. And so, yes, those are issues. If what happens to the data, does it get transferred back to you? There should be, that's something where regulators could immediately get involved and make sure these companies are strictly observing the idea of returning your data to you.
It sounds like that's something the industry in time would probably agree with to build business
confidence. They want to self-regulate. They don't want the government with their mitts in there because the government always manages to muck things up.
Hmm. Sue in Cambridge, Massachusetts. You're on the air, Sue.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I'd like to just offer my voice as a cheerleader for cloud computing because I'm the founder and the executive director of a small nonprofit. And we don't have a lot of money to have things like office space or to pay any employees. And so since this new, it seems like it's been just really in the last year, we've discovered ways to enlist volunteer work and manage projects all online. Of course, donor databases can be all online sharing from computer to computer.
Mm-hmm.
And it's made a huge difference in our ability to be really effective and not have to spend a lot of money in order to be effective. So when I think for all nonprofits everywhere, things like cloud computing and being able to work online and work with people that are across the country has made made our ability to make our missions more more able to be met.
Yeah,
much more easy.
Sue, our time is short, but it's a great point. I mean, Jonathan, there's a sort of a cheerleader for the liberating side of the cost savings here. I got a question on the other side of that. This is from the website, where a listener asks, if we have to keep everything up in the cloud, how do we overcome bandwidth limitations from the internet service providers? Kara, what about that? I mean, not everybody has a super connection to the internet. Does this preclude people with slow, narrow, skinny connections?
Yes, it does.
Ouch.
I mean, here's the thing. The government, that's where our government again. I mean, right now, I always say, it's sort of like the government back in the early part of the century said, dirt roads are just great. Let's not build a state highway system. I mean, it's kind of appalling the way our government treats this critically important issue, especially because much smaller countries than ourselves, much less developed countries than ourselves, have amazing systems. And so we have to address the bandwidth issue. Of course, it's being addressed technologically, but it has to be addressed on a much larger level where this is an inevitable and important federal initiative. I mean, I don't see why it isn't at this point.
So get bandwidth out there for all Americans if we could. It'd be great. And Jonathan, what about? I mean, you've got several proposals here. Kara says, don't get the government in here. They'll just muck it up. What do you see coming? Do you see government intervention? Do you see industry deliberately taking some steps to address the kinds of concerns that you're raising? Or are we just going into a new world here?
Well, I think that industry can be counted on to do what's in its interest. And often what's in its interest is to satisfy consumers. That's how the market works, ideally. And so if we can have the cheerleading very excited about the prospects and the things that are opened up. And in that sense, there is no doubt that the state of the internet right now, at least in a place like the United States, is that much more exciting than it was before. But I also want to be raising concerns so that these companies actually will give something back and have a way of tempering some of the sharp edges that could come back to cut us later. And I see this not only as ultimately cloud computing hooking processors together, but I think we're starting to see it hooking people together more and more. If you want to get something done in the world and put human labor, the human mind, to the task, you can kind of hire it over the cloud the way that you would hire more server space to make your website more robust. You can put out a task for $15,000. A company might need a molecule sequenced that has a certain characteristic. They put it out for a $15,000 bounty, and somebody emerges from the woodwork to do it. Or if you just need little things done, you could put it out on Amazon Mechanical Turk at a nickel a pop. So it's these kinds of things that means the cloud is here to stay, and it's going to be a cloud of people, not just machines.
Big horizon coming up here, and we understand it better thanks to the two of you today. Jonathan Zittrain at Harvard Law School, the Berkman Center there. Thanks, Jonathan. Thank you for being with us.
Thanks, Tom. A pleasure.
And Kara Swisher with The Wall Street Journal joining us from San Francisco. Thank you so much, Kara.
Thanks a lot.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.